This was the first expedition that had the state-of-the-art camera system allowing them to get inside and roam the compartments. The camera fit the plan to find where the gold lay in stow. A bunch of modern-day treasure hunters, to be sure, they were. A nice term for pirates with expensive gear that used technology for every edge it could give them. The bulk of the cost was in high-tech, hand-built devices that had only one use, to search Titanic. But they never saw it that way. To be sure, now it was on the minds of all the crew, the millions in gold, just waiting there as shiny new as the day they were put into the chest. They were sure the gold bars would be 99% pure. No one had claimed to have found the cash. If they had, would they even have admitted it? The waves crashed against the ship as Jade and Johns walked to Nemo. Masters turned to the restless bunch. The weather's holding. The dive is on. We're a go, he said. Johns warned Jade. It's no secret, the danger and risk. The only way down is in Nemo. There's all kinds of things that could go wrong. Equipment can fail. A $10 part can fail, he said. Lights can implode, and if that happens, well? Jade focused on the horizon. She glanced nervously at Flynn as he stood, waiting patiently next to Nautilus. John's never missed a beat. I mean, she's tested. The problem is we're balancing human technology against the force of the sea at 2 miles down. Water's below freezing, darker than dark. All you got is 9 inches of steel and iron between you and oblivion. Get to the dangerous part, already, seethed Flynn. Jade looked down at the water below. The weather was unusually warm. Set your frequency to 122 to transmit, Dudley said. Masters looked at his watch. Yeah, he replied. 122, said Flynn. Got it. Johns was ready as he moved toward Nemo. She's not built for beauty or speed, but she kicks ass, Johns bragged. Jade turned the video cam on for the last footage on the top side as she zoomed in on Nemo's dark, enigmatic eyes, quiet and still, before they went down in the depths of the cold ocean. Nemo was new and sleek with big eyes at the front that served as windows. She and her twin, Nautilus, were built for this venture. Specifics of pressure and cold and maneuverability, housing the external cam and lights were all taken into account in their designs. Nemo was engraved on the side. Johns went and patted her exterior plating the way men liked to do. It's just like flying a helicopter, except we freefall to the bottom. It's like 3 hours to get down. We've got sensor booms of 8,000 watts of light. You're gonna love the external cam, said Johns. Her shape was designed for three, a bit tight, but workable. Masters stretched out his arm and motioned for her to climb aboard, and he, Johns, and Jade moved toward the submersible, as Mac filmed them. The dark eyes of the small craft greeted them. Soon Nemo would be emitting her eerie, incandescent green glow once more, pointing the way into the very depths of the ghostly waters with the enticing beautiful lady, 2.5 miles directly below them. Masters opened the metal hatch, took off his shoes and climbed in. Johns, too, entered in socks. The hatch was a thick piece, slick new metal, round like a steering wheel and wet from the ocean spray. He and Johns entered Nemo like they had done this 100 times before. Jade, daunted by the thoughts intruding upon her placid expression, placed the camera in her bag and climbed down the ladder. Mac caught the shot of Jade's final departure reaching down to the handrail as she gave him a last look. She glanced at the horizon, its hue now a soft, light, turquoise blue, with marble clouds hanging low against the sky, He felt sure against the step, and then suddenly she felt Master's strong hands about her waist. It caught her off guard. They took her body on inside and snugged her into her spot. She felt his grip for a while, lingering on her skin. She wanted to feel it. She didn't want to let go of that warmth, that touch. She couldn't help herself. His magnetism hit her like an electrical charge. Neemal smelled like sea brine mixed with new car scent. Jade could smell Master's too and could still feel the touch of his tender grasp about her waist. She was thinking about all that was happening, but the effect of Master's hands, she hadn't expected that. It stuck with her. She couldn't get it out of her head. She hadn't been touched in a long time. She felt her skin warm, as if his hands were still grasping her. But it all happened so fast. She was inside. 100 buttons, lights and gears, like a cockpit of a small plane, with cameras, lights and other devices she had not much idea how to read. The entire sphere was configured with technical gadgetry. Every inch of the circular ceiling and sides were paneled with equipment. The dash was all tricked out with a monitor and a joystick that looked like a prototype for video games. The monitor bleeped a pulsing line, always very techno and sophisticated. Although it was not old, the hatch squeaked as John's strong hand slammed it closed behind her. The harsh clanging of metal upon metal settled the issue of whether she was going or not, once and for all. John's then drove the wheel, spinning it in a clockwise fashion, securing it tight. Then he turned to Jade. "That's the hatch. Don't open it for any reason." He had a sense of humor, which was needed around Master's stark nature. There was nothing funny. Jade was overwhelmed by the whole experience. She looked to Master's, but he busied himself with the task at hand, playing little attention. The waves crashed mightily round the Atlantic's iron and the frosty wind clanged the metal chain against the sides of Neemal, as the hoist began to lift her into the air. "Up on the teleleg. Hook is set," said Dudley. "Extend to limit mark." Atlantic's iron, with its rust-speckled, faded, red-painted hull, held fast against the sea, as Neemal swung restless on her winch, from the swells. "Pilot, confirm your thrusters," yelled Dudley. "Dampers off," said the operator, Pete. Then, with almost military precision, Neemal angled and hovered over the aquamarine blue sea, like some wriggling invertebrate on a hook at the end of a fishing line. Neemal took its place in the water. Billy's black, wet-suited figure swam out and climbed on top of her and cast off her main lift line. "Surface check. Unpowered activation of the service weights. Jettison switches. Vent valve open. ID light on. Hatch is shut." John's double-checked the hatch was locked in position. "Oxygen on. Scrubber on. UQC check on. Tracking on. Leaks normal." "Jettison normal," said Masters. "Remove safety lines." Billy cleared the tail line in tension mode. Neemal was free, back in her own environment again at last. Billy was clear. "Slack the tail," he yelled. A dinghy, pounding the waves, came and picked him up from the tedious endeavor. "Request launch altitude and permission to dive," said Johns. "Sign off," said Pete. "Neemal away." "Nautilus ready," Dudley gauged. He was in command of the launch process, pleased with himself that everything seemed to be going smoothly so far. Inside, the green lights from Nemo's dashboard lit the interior. As Jade glanced out of the porthole eye, She caught a last brief glimpse of the surface. She held on, as the rough sea rocked her into seasickness, worsened by Nemo's tight interior. "I feel awful," she thought. She only wished she could make it without embarrassment. Not seeing the horizon made it all the worse. There was nowhere to focus. Her stomach didn't know its function anymore. It was all she could do to not give in. Up top, Nautilus was then in turn lifted on the winch and slowly lowered over. The small craft did not have the give that Atlantic Siren had, where you can watch the horizon and balance the unsettling nauseous feeling that one unaccustomed to the ways of the sea might have. Mac held on, embarrassed, overcome with an urge to return his breakfast to the bag he had been given by Flynn. Mac's face looked out staring from the port window as Nautilus settled herself into the rough ocean. Flynn did his formal checks. Billy watched Nautilus rock back and forth as she lowered. He swiftly swam to set her free and then moved off to the dinghy, as she managed the ocean's endless pounding and deep swells, for she was never, even at her calmest, a quiet sea. In the restricted confines of Nemo's interior, it was all too easy for Jade's fear to wear green on her face. Her hands glistened sweat as they feverishly gripped the handle edge, frantically seeking the assurance of some kind of solidness to cling onto. Heart-pounding fear she hadn't known before had come to the fore and set in, as the perilous trip was about to begin and Nemo rocked about. "She's feeling it now," Astris thought. "Don't worry. It gets better," said Johns. Temporarily he empathized with her situation as he recalled his own first dive, and then his hand instinctively pushed the gears to move down into the ultramarine light below. Even the toughest felt queasy the first few minutes. Masters was contemplative, and quiet too, and he glanced sideways at Jade, watching her anxiety level rise. He thought he knew what to expect from her. "Submerge. Nemo driving," ordered Masters. The submersible jolted violently as it began its long descent under the water. Jade continued to look nervous as Nemo, seemingly out of control, gathered speed and swung around. Under her breath she let out a gasp as the bouncing, swinging sensation took hold. "This isn't fun," she thought. But she might as well have vented her feelings aloud, for the sea would echo no remembrance of her words, and Johns and Masters had felt it all before. These waters had heard far worse screams. Titanic was witness to that. "Secure the main ballast vents," said Masters. For the first few seconds of the white knuckle ride everyone held on, little to do but get under waves. "Don't worry. The current will subside." "Hang on," said Johns. He'd been through it on his first trip. It happened to the best of them. The shaky and unnerving tossing in the current suddenly went still. At this depth the water was smooth and Nemo moved through it with ease. The turbulence had receded slowly and then ceased altogether as the soft, bluish glow of the light above gradually dimmed and finally faded away. Nemo was at total peace with the world now, in the depths of the quiet waters. Now they were all alone in a black, silent world, at one with the ocean and its inhabitants. Down into the dark they ventured, to a place where no light was seen through the window. This was the haven of whales and dolphins on long journeys, where they rode deep in these waters, while covering miles in silent stride. But they would not be seen by this craft, as she rode down dark, saving the power till the needed moment. 10 meters. "Switch to UQC. Radio the depth," ordered Masters. 10 meters, radioed Johns. "Copy," radioed Dudley. Masters surreptitiously took a sideways look at Jade again, trying to discern her mood. He said nothing, letting her become accustomed to her surroundings and the entire ordeal. It was enough that she was going down into the dark depths of the ghostly waters of the North Atlantic, but with the added fear associated with riding the little submersible, it had become a terrifying episode for her. He felt a quiet admiration for her fortitude and the fact that she was not ashamed to show her fear. The melting touch of her waist set his hands on fire. The feel of her weight and the brush of her soft hair were dangerous, as they sank into his soul. Masters tuned in the dial of the radio intercom to distract him, as if that would help. Atlantic Siren, this is Nemo at frequency 122. Over, he said. His calmness and sure authority made Jade feel slightly less tense. He moved the dial a bit, locking in the frequency to hear from the mothership. Atlantic Siren, this is Nemo, come in. We're on the stern starboard run, Masters said. The radio made some whirly sound. 200 meters, said Masters. Jones flipped the dash cockpit switches. Nemo's two green eyes were active once more, as Jones tested them. They penetrated the endless dark waters below. Once again they seemed to be perfectly at ease in the deep and signaled silently to all the other creatures around to give way. The radio made a scratchy noise. Atlantic Siren. Nemo is underway. Copy, said Masters. Topside, do you read me? Over. Up top, Dudley heard, but the connection was weak. This is Atlantic Siren, Nemo. We got you, he said. We see you. Masters waited for confirmation before they moved on. Hold tight, he said to Johns, and Johns halted the descent till further word. Atlantic Siren. Nemo underway. Copy, Masters repeated. Do you read me? Over. Nemo, we read you, returned Dudley on top. Good to go. Copy, Masters replied. Roger, said Dudley. Let's hear from Nautilus. In the daunting water, Nautilus sat still and silent, waiting in check mode as well. She flashed her lights to be seen by Nemo. Flynn grabbed the mic. Nautilus to Atlantic Siren. Light check. Those fuckers better not implode. Copy. You tested him. Send me a pic. Over, said Greg. Roger that. I'll send you 100. Copy, said Flynn. You two stop kissing. Give me your PSI. Over, said Dudley. Flynn hit the switch as Nautilus' eyes went full, shooting out rays of light, giving the sea a turquoise black hue. He hit another switch, the dash lit the cockpit, the sonic monitor came on. Triple check. We're good. Copy, Flynn said. Is that a good to go? Asked Dudley. Copy, he said. Nemo. Reporting 3,000 PSI. Copy, said Masters. Nautilus, 3,000 PSI. Copy, said Flynn. Dudley gave the thumbs up and a glance to the water below. All right then, carry on, he gleamed. Nautilus to Atlantic Siren underway. Roger, came Flynn on the radio. Secure the main ballast vents, ordered Masters. Secure the main ballast vents, ordered Danny. Jones hit the lights off to free fall power mode and with that they went down, into the ghostly, black waters. Nemo descended inexorably, quietly, into the depths, with eyes dark till needed. All the while, closer and closer, they headed towards the secret cargo they all hoped was below. Nemo's silent motor made for a smooth ride. The deep water was quiet and inviting. It had a peaceful lure. Not so the tight quarters that Jade was crammed in, but at least she felt stable and the queasy torture had subsided. Johns fiddled with the switches that manually controlled the cabin pressure and the main ballast pressure system. Depth indicators good. Battery voltage good, said Johns. Fathometer good. Jade had almost forgotten what it was all for, the excursion to Titanic. Johns interrupted her thoughts. He opened a small compartment and retrieved an oxygen mask attached to a canister marked emergency. In an offhand way, he modeled it to Jade in imitation of an airline stewardess performing a similar duty. Oxygen, he said. She got the drift. He slung the canister back into the compartment and closed the cabinet again abruptly. Masters noticed she was still gripping the arm handle. The two men both stared dispassionately at her as she sat there, trying to appear calm. They had little sympathy that someone else was as terrified as they had been on their first ride into those black, unforgiving depths. Masters watched the gauges closely, casting his experienced eye over them. The blip of the sonar was his main focus. Jade watched the flashing dashboard lights, knowing they were the link to life and death. Not being able to decipher the readings herself, she felt at the mercy of the great ocean all around them. She took her pack and slipped out her camera, adjusted it to focus on the dash where Master's attention was. The altimeter showed them that they were just passing the 500 feet mark. At this depth, all of the reassuring surface light had disappeared and the temperature on the exterior thermometer had dropped well below freezing. The gauge reads 28 degrees Fahrenheit, about the same temperature as the water surface temperature Titanic faced, Flynn's voice came over the radio. The freezing temperature of seawater is significantly lower than fresh water, due to the high salt content, so we're able to make our way, added Johns. Jay took note that only she would freeze and not the water. Meanwhile in Nautilus, Flynn had Dudley on radio, up top on the surface, high above them. Nautilus to Atlantic Siren. Triple check. We're good. Copy, grinned Flynn. Nautilus to Atlantic Siren. Still descending. Just passing 700 feet. Only another 12,000 to go. Over, Johns quipped. Okay, copy, Dudley replied, safe and secure in the mothership. The pressure of being cooped up in the tiny craft was apparent as Masters adjusted, rubbing his back. He watched Jade as she moved into a better position so her legs didn't fall asleep. He was curious about this intriguing woman. She was an enigma. A closed book. Perhaps the tough exterior was coupled with a soft center. That was a most appealing combination. She felt the moment might be right to ask. How did you get hooked on Titanic? There are a lot of wrecks. Only by diving can you be there, only then, and with patience to get there, can the history of Titanic, her size, her stature, be real. Only then can one let Her Majesty seep into the soul. Then she becomes the grace and embodiment of shipbuilding. She's haunting, and now her stories are mingled with the ancient sea and its mysterious realm. And then there's the romantic lure. How did you get into filming? I like how the camera separates the moments in time, how it captures the reality of who we are, how it sees people's faces. Sometimes unglamorous, but always capturing reality, how it gives you the ability to relive time. It's new and fascinating, a 100-year-old art, and yet it has drawn us all in, with its ability to frame life. Her soft words and her eyes were mesmerizing. Suddenly, Nemo began to vibrate just as the lights flashed off and immediately back on again. Jade looked scared out of her wits. She clutched the camera tightly and braced against her seat. Her knuckles went to ghostly white. The vibration fell out of place, wrong. John's piped up, "It's all perfectly normal. Relax." She rubbed her throat, wanting water, but not wanting to pee. She sucked on a lemon slice instead. Throughout the long descent to the ocean floor, Masters watched the pressure gauge intently. He felt the pressure building in his ears and held his nose to clear it. Jade followed suit. She noticed the smell. "Is it always this tank?" she thought to herself. It took forever to get there. This kind of dive was tough on the nerves, and there wasn't much to do on the way down except think. The danger of it all would not leave her mind. This tiny can. This is it. The only protection against inevitable death bursting in uninvited from the unforgiving ocean. This thought went round and round in her mind. The gauges were sweating with condensation at this depth. Masters wiped them clear. It began to get even colder. Jade could feel it. 3 hours passed incredibly slowly, and they were nearing their ultimate destination. Outside, the pressure was now almost 6,000 psi, pounds per square inch. It was cold down here. Faint creaks and the hum of the submotor broke the silence. "Lights on," Flynn was happy to say. Flynn's voice took Jade's mind off how cold she was. She kept it to herself. Masters felt it the most. It was miserable how the metal held the cold and damp in his cramped joints and old bones, and made it worse. His legs stiffened and hurt in this tight position. Every kink in these self-imposed quarters he'd resigned himself to was hurting. There was a sound as a plastic bottle cap popped open and Masters downed some painkillers for his aching back. He never said anything, never complained. 500 meters. Wheels start up, mission equipment. Switched to top transducer for communications, ordered Masters. Nautilus, following in their slipstream, shot out the high beam light. Nemo's light eyes too probed the dark depths with its eerie searchlights, out into what looked like a forever of water, a liquid galaxy stretching miles in every direction, endless deep. At this depth, moving through the glassy water to locate the most famous shipwreck in history was indeed the ultimate adventure. It was only tempered with a great sense of their goals, the gold. Flynn flipped the monitor on and got on the intercom radio. "Nemo, we got stereoscopic cam on." "Copy," said Flynn. Masters carefully and intently watched the sonar on the vessel's small dashboard. "Lights on," Masters focused. "Sonic on." "Copy," replied Dudley, back on board the surface controller equipment. "We got eyes," said Masters in turn. "Zoom in. Check. 360 degrees rotate. Check. Cam on. Nautilus, copy. Cam on. Check. 360 degrees rotate. Check." Nautilus radioed. From the action in the cabin, Jade could tell they were nearing the bottom. "Nemo, where's your sonar?" queried Dudley. The sonar was not responding as Nemo descended through the icy blue water. "I'm not reading sonar here." "Over," Masters replied. "Sonar, can't find her?"
"Don't shit me," said Dudley.
"Hang on," said Masters.
"Where is she?" said Masters as he shut the radio receiver to offline.
"Bring me around," he ordered.
"She's big."
"The ocean is bigger," Johns replied. Masters tapped at the keyboard and the sonar came on, making resolution lines, but no clear shape.
They all stared hard at the haunting image that appeared. Could this be her? That's it. That's the valley. Take her down, Masters told him. Jade wondered why they couldn't exactly find Titanic, but it was all new technology and a lot of guesswork. Even though Masters had been there before, it was not like there was a street or a landmark. It was a general reading. Masters knew he was close. He tuned in the sonar for a new reading. They weighed in with awe and reverence as the form took shape. The graphic of the once mighty ocean liner's outline came clear. It was the shattered hulk of Titanic. I got the first sonar reading, said Masters. You getting this up top? Over. Shit it, sir. Heading down. Over, said Flynn. Roger, said Dudley. The noiseless cold sea let each small craft glide through it all too easily. Only Nemo's creaks and her dash lights made her an odd, out-of-place creature, here in the pitch black. Masters noted marks and bearings, as the strange submersible haunted the waters at the 2-mile depth. As they neared the bottom, Nemo's propeller agitated the powdery sand, forming smoky clouds. At 75 meters off bottom, drop weights, ordered Masters. Descent weights ready, said Johns. Give me a visual on that, said Masters. Then a slight jolt was felt on the port side as the weight fell off. Never mind. I feel it. Confirm weights away. Log time and start bottom time. Surface controller. Copy. Copy, said Pete over the intercom. Call in 30 minutes. Jade's eyes were glued to the port window in expectation. Johns nudged her. She was supposed to be filming. Oh right, she thought. She put the camera to the glass and got the timeless images. A shot of the huge funnel came into view. They knew they were really here. They followed along the sandy bottom, as the glimpses of ocean-worn relics from another time came into sight. The boom camera filmed the sandy ocean floor and brought up the first photos, which came up on the monitor. They were on the trail. A shovel and a steel wheel that looked like it belonged in the engine room were lying in the sand. The debris trail was not hard to follow. The rusting metal remnants were definitely debris from the ship, yet they were preserved, almost intact, by the intense cold and lack of oxygen at these depths. Nautilus reporting, said Flynn. We are moving through the debris field. Copy. We have your position. Roger, Masters assured him. Copy that, said Danny. Adjust that reading, interjected Masters. Roger, confirmed Danny in turn. Some knives and forks still in the rack, and a shelf of cups were just lying there, sticking out of the sand. A large trunk and a leather bag lay open on the seafloor, possessions these souls would never need again. The eerie glow from the boom lights revealed even more poignant sights. China plates still intact, the White Star logo still clearly visible. A child's doll lay next to the well-preserved little boot of a young girl. A tear welled up in Jade's eye. No one spoke for the longest time. It took them back in time to April 15, 1912, living through that unspeakable night, in all its horror. Titanic objects and pieces of the ship were scattered across the seabed. Entering debris field. Copy, said Johns. Roger that, right behind you, said Flynn. As they neared the stern, the debris littered the ocean floor. Wine bottles, still in the case, the corks still intact. Shit. I would love to taste that. Don't you wish we could get those? Said Johns.
That's probably a 1902 vintage from France. Right there. This was the first of the two debris fields in the vicinity of the wreck, each around 2,500 feet long, trailing in a southwesterly direction from the Bowensdern. They covered 2 square miles. Most of the debris was near the stern section of Titanic, where thousands of objects from the interior of the ship had spilled out, looking out of place: suitcases, clothes, wine bottles, many intact despite the pressure, bathtubs, windows, wash basins, jugs, bowls, hand mirrors, and numerous other personal effects. Jade spotted a pile of tons of coal spilled from ruptured bunkers, numerous pieces of the ship itself, and large pieces of ship metal, in the vicinity of the disintegrated stern section. Nearer, ever nearer, they approached the ghost-like wreck site. From the underbelly of Nemo, the camera sent up video to the monitor. As they came into focus, more ship debris, rusticles and pieces of battered steel were recorded. Then suddenly the spell was broken, as Masters put the controls in Jade's hand. Then he clenched another remote and turned on the exterior black and white camera. The exterior cam came on. Masters focused on shooting stills for his detailed mosaic presentation. This was the camera that he was thrilled about. The photos could be blown up many times before they lost detail. The camera was the piece de resistance of the equipment, and it would bring close the reality of Titanic. Jane watched the small monitor displaying the pictures being picked up by the exterior cameras. A few minutes passed, and then, finally, the sight they had all been waiting for. The object of the expedition, the busted hull of Titanic, was revealed in all its magnificence. Then the silence was pierced by Flynn's voice from Nautilus. "Oh yeah. I can see her now." "Yeah." "Oh," said Danny. "Look at that," Masters continued, awestruck. "We're in front of a massive wall of steel." "Copy," said Danny. Only a very select few individuals had ever been privy to this extraordinary moment. This view astonished. There she was in all her faded glory, the ship of dreams. All the fear and trepidation Jade had held were foolishly diluted in the exhilaration of the moment. Her heart flowed with a rim of a fervent flood. "So that's Titanic," Jade delighted. "Yeah, it looks different." Suddenly the images on the blip monitor became all lines and squiggles and drop out. "I'm getting interference?" "Over." Masters did not like this. Suddenly lights began flashing on the dashboard in front of them all. "We're losing the readings," he continued. "Shit. We're not reading." "We can't see," John said. "Malfunction," said Masters. "Check the port." Jade jumped to the port window and saw through the 9-inch thick glass. Her heartbeat tripped in unnatural revolutions of assorted thumps. Some fluid was leaking out of the exterior equipment. "It's leaking," she gasped. The light sensors shorted out. "Shit." John's had the word they all felt. Masters came to look for himself. Fluid was oozing fast. He lunged to the controls, his stiff limbs dared to feel the pain. John's knew it was true by the concern Masters showed. "Turn off cams 1 and 2. Mark course." "We're leaking what?" gasped John's. Masters was ensconced at the panels. He tried the sensor panel dials and switched the drives, worry lines etched on his brow. Jones had his sharp eye on the various pieces of equipment that surrounded the sphere. That hid his nervous pallor, but inside he shook. "Abort, abort. Surface," said Masters. "Atlantic Siren Nemo coming up. Abort." "Copy,"
Dive one is abort. Copy, said Johns. Switch to, Masters said. Masters looked out the window, but the leak was still there. Shit, he thought. It was urgent. It could be any little thing that ended their lives. Get the hell out of here, he hurried. Switching to a 100%. Copy. Johns replied. From up top, you're shitting me. What's the problem? Over. Dudley yelled. Hey, Masters yelled, we're out of here. Copy. He hit the mic offline. Get us out of here. Flynn heard the call. He knew that meant him too, for the drives were to be done in twos for reasons of safety. Abort dive. Abort dive, he repeated to Danny. Nemo copy. Up up up. Let's go, yelled Johns. He was on the controls wishing he had a Porsche engine. Mac was freaked. What's happening? His urgent tone asked. What's going on? Shit. Release ascent weights 100 meters from Titanic. Notify surface to complete pre-recovery warm-ups and checks. Stow all equipment. Jade watched, stressed, as the interior lights flashed. Masters watched Jade as Nemo headed up. And so ended abruptly the date with Titanic. Chapter 7. Atlantic Siren, 1993. Back on the surface, the crew had been waiting and was ready to receive them. Dudley stood by, uptight. It's pretty choppy up here, Greg informed them by radio. We know, replied Masters. Billy jumped in for Nemo as she sloshed about in the choppy water, whipping up swells. Inside the small submersibles they were tossed. It seemed this would be the routine, bobbing in the water like an apple in a barrel. Jade was seasick. Johns passed her a bag. They finally were attached to the A-frame and secure on deck. Masters was angry as he climbed out of Nemo's small hatch by what he saw as an unnecessary delay. They all regrouped on deck. I saw Titanic for 10 seconds, Masters, agitated, pulled off his gloves and went for the logbook. Start looking for the problem. Start with the battery, he ordered Flynn. You want me to work on it in this rough weather? It's nearly impossible. All this rockin', replied Flynn, risking the wrath of Masters. By now Mac had his camera and was catching the agitated Masters. Turn that thing off, Masters wasn't in the mood. We can't go back to port. No going back to port, Dudley was adamant. He said it. Work all night if you have to. We have 12 dives to get in. I don't want to hear excuses, snapped Masters. Log it for the record. We dive tomorrow, railed Masters, and he moved off. Pull the battery, Dudley ordered. We are losing time. Yeah, said Flynn. Masters, away from Titanic, was his old self, antisocial, as he angrily left without so much as a backward glance. Flynn and Danny unhooked the boom camera. Mac was glad to see Jade. What the hell happened? Mac asked. She shrugged her shoulders as Mac, lugging the camera, filmed them heading inside. Get some coffee, said Flynn, and Danny went to find some. A pitch black dark covered the sky on this shivering cold night, at least 4 degrees below freezing. There was no moon, but a million minuscule stars could be seen in the blackness of the night sky. He seems rather antisocial except when near Titanic, Jade observed. Flynn looked up from his work.
That stuff about the ship deteriorating is only half true. The real problem is the French and the Russians. What they didn't get, the museum did. She's real picked over. It's when they land on her, that caves in. Masters just wants it preserved for as long as she can last, he said. Flynn had held back things that he knew. Never was he to be the chatty type. He never offered up much. He had only met Jade, she was easy to talk to, but he was just more comfortable not talking. Talking meant connecting, looking people in the eye, it put him on the spot. He had been on the previous dives with Masters. He had enjoyed the high stakes and the high pay, but he had taken note. He had seen the evidence of destruction firsthand and he knew Masters was angry that Titanic's wreck was boarded and dismantled for profit. With every dive there was evidence that more of Titanic's fixtures were missing. Anything that was possible to remove was slowly being taken and sold to the highest bidder. They cared not that the deck was being used as landing area for 20th century nautical machines, crushing it in with every trip. They cared not that the abrupt removal of fixtures weakened the structure. Nor did they care to preserve her as she lay. The goal was always about retrieving a piece of Titanic. A light fixture, a brass plaque, a porthole, all brought a high price. And with the new technology, it was apparent that the rays would now focus inside, to what once had only been accessible to the fish and sea creatures that had made Titanic their luxurious haunt. Though the creatures cared little for the exquisite decor and fine carpet wood trim, or the luxury of the staterooms, they were the rightful inheritors of this deep treasure chest full of places to explore. A mirror still intact in one of the staterooms caused the fish to pause and wonder at their reflection. They needed no permission, no ticket. They traveled easily from upper class to the lower class deck with no concern other than of what prey might they stalk or what might be stalking them. As Titanic lay in her sea grave, she was home to many lingering there, who had dared to search her every nook and cranny. Much of Titanic's charm and artistry might not be admired by the sea creatures, but they would roam free in the comfort of the home that she graced them with. Flynn kept it all to himself, sticking to the job at hand, mumbling tech talk to avoid any real conversation. He disconnected the external battery cable. There's a small fluid leak there, and a grounding issue. We'll have this ready by morning, he said. You could have told me it was just the camera battery. I thought we were going down. Jade recalled. Did you know Titanic's maiden voyage at Southampton had a near miss? He reached for a tool and looked at her with a glance wondering. Shit. You knew that? How did you know that? Chapter 8. Southampton Docks, England. Titanic's maiden voyage, 1912. Captain Smith gave his orders from atop the bridge that cold gray English day. Away lines, he ordered. Away lines, yelled the first officer. At 12 o'clock noon prompt on this dark day, the most beautiful ship ever, cast off from her moorings. Her name was Titanic. She was touted unsinkable, the legendary ship of dreams. She made her way from the quayside to the broad open spaces of Southampton Water, from the White Star Dock. At the head of the bridge, Smith combed his beard with his nervous hand. It was the captain's most noted characteristic and it gave him a degree in presence that established his unquestioned authority. Well-earned, deep wrinkles it surrounded his eyes, as they looked out from the deck. He was all the part of a captain in his white uniform and hat. And his white beard set the whole thing off. This was his ship. No one dared second guess him or presume they were in his league. He was well loved by the passengers for his charm and wit. He had had a long seafaring history. His was a face that you felt you trusted, sailing you about the vast ocean.
He seemed quiet, like he was always thinking about the details of the voyage, but yet still interested in making sure the passengers were having a delightful passage. It wasn't hard, in the luxury of the greatest ship in the world. And it may have been this fact alone that led the passengers to turn to him and trust him so, for surely the man who would captain such a world-class ship must be something in his own right, and he did look the part. As he stood there sporting his beard, he looked studious to all. First Officer Murdoch wore his uniform well. He was fit and tall, and easily held the attention of women who were attracted to men in uniform. His deep-set eyes caught sight of everything. He was a good man to crew with. He knew his way around the ocean. He'd been on ships of all sorts since a young age, but none so fine as Titanic. He was now an officer, not a greaser or coal shoveler, but a fine first officer, clean-shaven, and spit-shined shoes, stepping to the orders. And now here he was on the voyage everyone was talking about, the greatest ship with the most popular captain. He was strangely stiff, despite all of this. "How the blithers did we manage to get all the coal for this voyage?" he thought. "We're the only ship leaving port and all the others are stuck at the docks. I bet the strikers aren't too happy with Titanic's owners." Britain was in the grip of a severe coal strike. Liners were literally stranded in Southampton. Two were in berth at number 38, empty, the Oceanic in New York. They moored together at Southampton Quayside laid up for lack of coal. For her maiden voyage, Morgan bought what coal he could from these and other idle ships to provide the full quota of 6,000 tons for the trip. The crowds gathered on the dock and railings to get a glimpse of the famous, most expensive ship in the world, the floating wonder of the age. "She's massive," said a man looking on. "That's Titanic. Here, look," and he showed him the advertisement. Much had been made of this maiden voyage. The crowd knew that soon theater stars and millionaires would board her, if they weren't already on. This was the attraction of the times. She looked every bit the beauty she was advertised as, and brought a massive sense of luxury to the 20th century. The ribbon from her celebration still hung from the bowl, still wet with champagne. "She's brilliant, this one," said a woman setting up her camera. Smith nodded to the crowd as he watched at the bridge. More for fanfare than really doing anything, but he looked great up there. Titanic left her berth and made her way gingerly to the open spaces of Southampton water. She was pulled by four tugs to guide her out of port until she could come to her own with her propellers. A ship this size, with the triple screw configuration, could stir up the waters and disturb the ships tied to the docks, so they always used tugs to guide the giants. So huge was her body as she moved out that Captain Gale, commanding one of the tugs that was pulling Titanic, noticed the propellers were churning ever too much water, even as slow as they were. "Watch out for her wake," yelled Gale. He kept his eye on the current. He knew something wasn't right. Titanic's huge bronze propellers began to rotate faster and faster, building up a momentum that was soon displacing vast amounts of water. As Titanic majestically powered onwards, her triple screws moved tons of water in a powerful current towards the docked SS New York. The massive tethering ropes of the New York slackened and the ship rose upwards in the echo of the swell. The pressure on the mooring ropes strained to their absolute limits and beyond. The force of the water lifted her again, crashing against the dock. Three sharp cracks and the massive ropes snapped, like dry sticks. They flew out, shooting through the air and arcing back, flinging like a giant whip. Ropes thrashed, she began to drift broadside across the channel, sucked in towards Titanic. The two huge vessels were coming together. "We drew her in. We've pulled her off her tie. She's coming straight at us, sir," She's loose in the water unmanned, yelled the chief officer. Captain Smith looked out from the bridge, but the chief officer was hard-pressed to get him to act. Smith stood paralyzed as the unexpected mishap caught him off guard. It ran through his mind as he realized what was about to happen. The terrified first officer saw it all blank on Smith's face. "Captain, give the order. Give the order. Burn it port. Burn it port," he pleaded. He looked to Smith, but there was no answer behind his glassy stare. Something had come over Smith. His face turned white, like he could see his future before him. It overtook him and he just froze up. "She's coming straight at us. Christ," he said. Murdoch was frantic, his hand ready at the phone tube to make the call. But Smith was not reacting. "Sir, give the order. Burn it port." The chief officer's cold mouth steamed at the hot breath. Smith came to and took heed as he saw before his eyes the truth. The New York was off her tether. "Burn it port," Smith ordered to the helmsman, and the shaken chief officer repeated the order. "Burn it port." Into the phone tube, Murdoch's voice was breathing shallow to execute full effort to carry out the orders and divert the emergency. "Burn it port," he yelled into the telephone. The order from the bridge followed the tube's line down the stairs, passing the salt water fountain, then straight to the engine room where the greasers and the crew were covered in dirty coal dust. The engineer grabbed the tube to his ear. Out came Murdoch's order. "Burn it port, collision. Emergency." The engineer turned with a quick motion. Simultaneously, in the turbine engine room, the duty engineer got the call. "Stations," he yelled. The off-watch engineers made their way back to the machinery fast. The chief engineer ran in. "Full to port. Now. Give it all," he yelled. "The bastards. What do they expect?" The bell sounded as the chief officer pulled down hard on the brass lever handle, switching all the rudders in speed to position the ship to change path. The sound down in the engine room was loud. It was always loud. The engines were so huge, 3 stories or so, they were, the noise couldn't be helped. The men were tiny next to the likes of one of these rumbling monsters. They weren't about being quiet. They were for charging across the sea. All had to be yelled down there if you wanted anyone to hear you. On deck, Captain Smith stretched his head over the rail and saw the terror. It reflected in his eyes. He gasped. There was no time. The New York was controlled by the massive tonnage of water swelling fast toward Titanic. Smith stood, caught off guard. He knew there was no time to stop the engines on this massive forge ahead. "This is the maiden voyage. I can't believe," said Smith to himself. Murdoch saw it in his eyes. "Collision. Sir. Reverse engines," yelled the chief officer. "Give the order," ordered Smith. But his years at sea told him it was too late. The first officer was fast on the phone tube. In the engine room, the ring came. The engineer operator was swift to answer. "Reverse engines," came out of the line. The engine operator turned and screamed to the chief engineer. "Reverse engines. Reverse engines." He ran to the levers. The brass handles moved swiftly under his hands, ringing tones as they commanded action from the pumps. "It'll never stop. Have they not seen the size of propeller pushing us?" he said. "Station alert."
The rush in the turbine engine room was horrific as the duty engineer answered to stop.
What's he asking?
The shaft and propeller will rotate in the ahead. There's no stopping her fast and we'll get the blame.
Up top, Captain Smith's ISS New York was coming, and fast.
Titanic's new hull and prestige would be damaged for sure.
Murdoch was on the deck now.
He was hard-pressed to believe what he was seeing.
My God.
Watch it.
She's going to hit, said a man on the docks.
The passengers stared from the deck, realizing the fate.
Smith ran to the side of the deck where he saw New York closer. In the engine room they waited the long moment. The engineer was all intent.
The bastards.
What happened?
We're only in port, he said.
The greasers stood by while